Fighting Hospital-Acquired Zombieism on this week's Insights in Nursing. Welcome back to another episode of Insights in Nursing. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to just say that it's been great to be back here. If you watched the previous episode, you will have seen that we recorded a live version of Insights in Nursing at the recent NTI 2011 conference in Chicago, and I had Ann Robinson there with me, and we interviewed two of the critical care nurses in attendance about one of their studies on healthy workplace and healthy work environments for nurses and respect. And it was just a great discussion about that and about speaking up when there's a problem with our patients and being assertive for our patient care. So it was really great to talk with them. If you haven't caught that episode, I would urge you to check it out. In fact, there's actually a video version of that. So when you check that episode out, head over there and watch the video if you want. In the meantime, we have a great action-packed episode scheduled, a couple of really good articles and one goofy article, which I couldn't resist putting in there. But before we do that, I want to introduce our two panelists for today. Really exciting to have Terry Schmidt back with us from nursestory.com and at Online Nursing on Twitter. Hey, Terry.
Hey, Jamie.
And also Ann Robinson joining us again. Ann is at Caring Ann on Twitter. And Ann, we still got to work on getting you a blog set up, but it's good to have you back.
Yeah, thank you. And I have purchased that website. It's just there's nothing on it.
There's nothing there. But caringann.com coming soon to a blog near you. So anyway, I wanted to start off with a story, Terry, that you sent. It's from a favorite nurse blogger. I think it's just very appropriate. It's an anonymous blogger called Those Emergency Blues. So you can check that blog out, and there's a link in the show notes. But Terry, why don't you give us a little background? You sent this link in, and this is just a really sad story.
So this article is basically about Kimberly Hyatt. She's a 50-year-old nurse, and she'd been practicing for 27 years. She was a critical care nurse at Seattle Children's Hospital, and she made a medication error. And unfortunately, with a critically ill child, and so this medication error contributed to the child's death. And what happened was she was fired. It was a horrible ordeal with the State Board of Nursing. She was sanctioned, et cetera, et cetera. So ultimately, over all of this trauma, she committed suicide and took her own life. So one medication error now has led to two deaths. And it was an interesting discussion of the culture that we create for nurses to report medication errors. If there's a culture like this, will someone even be honest when they make a medication error so that we can fix it?
I think that's the key point is just that we have so many opportunities to do the right thing. And one thing we talked about briefly when we were getting set up for the show today was the fact that what happens to physicians who make medication or surgical errors or other errors? I mean, are they fired by the hospital? No. And that's largely, I think, because their relationship with the hospital is one of an independent contractor working with the hospital rather than the nurse being a direct employee of the hospital. And I don't know what the fix is because it's just a sad situation. And you were involved in quality and patient safety. And, you know, how hard is it to get nurses to report things when they could get fired for reporting and being responsible patient care advocates when a mistake is made?
Well, we've really been working hard to get people to report and to speak up and really, you know, we want them to speak up and report so we can get to the root cause of the problem. I mean, what was going on? It doesn't really talk about that situation or what they did to evaluate their system of why that error even occurred. And to me, that's a bigger question. And, you know, we've shifted with our culture to get people to report. And then you have a situation like this that makes it, you're going to just take all those steps back after all this work we've done to get people to speak up. And so, but I then also know on the end of things, and this is, you know, this is that was the hospital's decision and their way of showing that they were taking the right action to handle the situation legally. And, you know, when you're talking about, you were talking about physicians, and I was thinking more of malpractice insurance. So the physician carries their own malpractice insurance, where the hospital malpractice insurance covers the nurses. So, you know, I don't, it's difficult, and I know why hospitals are firing people for such a drastic error, but yet then on the other end of it, we've got to get everybody to report the errors. So it's kind of a two-edged sword situation.
You know, I think that's a good point, and I just want to make two more points on top of that. Number one, and this is going to sound a little bit cynical, when we take a 50-year nurse, a 50-year-old nurse who's a 27-year veteran, pardon me, part of me wonders if it's easier to fire her because she's going to cost us a lot of money, and she doesn't have that many more years of work, and we've got retirement coming up. And replacing a nurse is not that difficult. Replacing a physician is much more difficult. And in fact, in the new managed care models we've got, the physicians are employees of the health system as well and fall under the malpractice umbrella of the hospital. My point, my second point is, and the Anne so well pointed out, is that nurses don't carry their own liability insurance. Many times they're advised not to by their employers because that will, quote, make them a target for being sued. However, I advise all of my students to carry their own liability insurance the rest of their lives, because should something like this happen, their employer will fire them and then they'll be stuck. Should there be a civil suit or anything else, number one. Number two, the statute of limitations could be long and they could move jobs. And for something that happened at a previous employer, they're not going to be covered. And number three, you never know when you're going to be the scapegoat. So it's good for all nurses to carry their own liability insurance, whether you share that with your employer or not. That information that you carry, that is personally up to you. But
And how does it make you a target? I mean, I'd like to see the data that backs that up, because
I know, but that's what they like to say. You might be sued because, you know, you have this money and it's so cheap. It's $80 a year for a practicing nurse to carry their own liability insurance. And we should be telling them from the day they graduate nursing school.
It doesn't make any sense to not carry it. And I can't believe, I think the problem is hospitals, you know, when there's another set of lawyers in the room, because every insurance company sends their own lawyer, you end up with a conflict, because now you're going to pay half, we're going to pay half, or they're going to look at liability and shift blame from one person to another. The hospital has the insurance, and that policy is for the hospital. There's no objective reason to protect the nurse at all.
Well, but the hospitals always state that they have insurance and it is to protect you as an employee. Not only in hospitals, any healthcare organizations. I worked for a county health department, and the county government had insurance to protect what we did medically. I mean, they state that, and I mean, I've actually helped put them in place and evaluate the different insurance plans that you can, the liability insurance plans you can get. And it is there to protect you as a nurse. And Terry's right. They do encourage you not to get your own. And it's because those lawyers will go after you in both ways. And then I've also seen situations where then the hospitals back down if the nurse has their own insurance. And then the hospital, again, will let you go easier knowing that you can just take care of yourself. But
I think there's a lot of sides to this. But I think that the real shame of it is that there needs to be an open policy regarding disciplinary situations that involve errors. I think it's clear that there was no intent or long-term issue with negligence, at least based on the article here, that would have brought that about. And I think that it's difficult to say that. Can everybody hear my dog barking upstairs? It's difficult to say exactly why somebody won't report an error if you have a policy that is going to automatically fire them based on someone else's decision about the severity of that error. Now, needless to say, a fatality is certainly, it's a difficult situation.
Well, and not only being fired in the face of an error, but depending on the error, reporting it then to the State Board of Nursing. I mean, if she had been truly negligent or she was looking to harm a patient, that would be one thing. But I'm sure there's rules about whether there's a fatality and how that gets reported. But, you know, we only get one license.
And there was a she was disciplined by the state. The state looked at her nursing license and came up with a fine and a probationary period. It's clear that the state didn't think that this was necessary to revoke her license. And so, you know, the hospital should, I mean, what did the hospital do to protect themselves by firing this nurse, other than just for public relations purposes? The insurance company didn't require them to fire the nurse.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, and we had a similar situation here. It wasn't with the medication error. It was with a child who had been abused and actually ended up dying. And the physician and the ER people and nobody reported the injuries, even though the child had already been in state custody. No one called Division of Family Services. And so when the investigator came in, of course, the nurse trying to be helpful was the one who spoke with him, the ER Dr. Wooden, the helicopter pilot, the paramedic, none of them. So they charged her with endangering the child because she had not personally called DFS. Now, she was one of, you know, 20 people in the case. And so the hospital fired her so they would not have to deal with it.
Oh my goodness. So here we stand up and try to be the patient's advocate, but then that one hits hard. Wow.
But that's what health systems do. It's not uncommon for them just to fire someone to make it easier. They're done with it if that person is gone. They don't have any culpability.
Well, and I'm not, and to be clear, I mean, it is the nurse's job to double check medications, to double check those things, but there's got to be a culpability placed on the environment in the hospital and the system and put in place, checks and balances put in place to protect patients from these types of errors. If the facility is not following the standard, or if the facility doesn't have an active system to reduce errors, there's got to be culpability there. But of course, it's easier to fire the nurse and make it look like it's an individual's fault rather than an organization's culture problem.
Well, and you know, when I worked in the previous hospitals I've worked in, that any time that we're administering medications to pediatric or neonates, it is always a double check system with another nurse. Yeah. So it makes me think back to, yes, where did the system fail? And they said an infant, so that's less than 1 year. I don't know if we have the exact age of the patient, but I mean, that I'm sure that's a pretty standard practice, that that's a double check. And so why wasn't there another nurse involved, or was there, you know, there's more to this. Was the order written correctly by the physician in the first place? Again, there's a whole system evaluation that needs to be done. And I would do anything to be able to be a fly on the wall during those root cause analysis discussions on this one.
Yeah, Anne makes a good point. And in fact, even pharmacies, you know, back in the day, we used to mix our own meds and mix our own stuff. And the pharmacies have gotten away from that. And in pediatric and neonatal ICUs, and particularly children's hospitals, the pharmacies have gone to drawing up doses ahead of time themselves, so that someone isn't stuck, you know, miscalculating. Because if you're talking 0.01 mLs of something, which can be with an infant, you don't want to drop 0.02 because you just doubled the medication. And so it would be interesting, I agree, Anne, to find out what the whole story, but this is very tragic that there was nothing, no support system at the hospital in place for her, either to re-educate her or to counsel her, psychological counseling. I mean, I would think that this would be a strain on the entire unit. And so it's not just about medications. It's about productivity and workplace culture too.
A healthy work environment. What are we doing?
We talked about that last week and talking about how errors happen. It's interesting. There's a link on that article that we discussed to Kevin Foe's blog, kevinmd.com. Kevin's a great social media presence for healthcare. He's a physician, and he talks about some of these issues and whether the hospital should fire her. And there's an interesting quote from a former hospital CEO, Paul Levy, who argues that that's basically saying that placing a blame on a single individual removes focus on the hospital's responsibility to, quote, improving system processes. Sorry. And I think that that's something we've already discussed. But, you know, with her suicide, Kevin says the tragedy has only been compounded, that, you know, this will happen again because there's no evidence that the hospital took any action to improve safety procedures. And that should have been the reaction they had, not firing the nurse. And if they did so, they've done it quietly so as not to point out that there was a problem in their process.
Yeah, good point, Jamie.
It's just a shame, and I think that I would urge you to check out last week's episode because it links very well to the recent release of the silent treatment study that the AACN has on their website at aacn.org and their Healthy Work Environment initiative that just talks about, you know, respect between coworkers, interdisciplinary training and education, and then also having a system in place that allows people to speak up and bring problems and concerns about their patients to the attention of the care team. And I think that there's just a great discussion about that and good links there to those particular initiatives and research studies. And I think that they relate very well to this. And we'll have to follow up, I think, if we get to NTI next year and talk about it, what they've seen in adoption of some of those findings in that silent treatment study, because I think it's easier to remain silent when there's this type of environment that is going to be antagonistic and disciplinary actions rather than educational actions.
Well, and I think just kind of looking at it then here a week later with this other information from this article, it'd be interesting to have a similar survey done in a hospital where a nurse was released for an error versus a hospital that a nurse has never been released for such an error before, and evaluating those different cultures and really the impact that the hospital actions had on the rest of the nursing staff and how they're going to respond. I mean, I bet you go talk to any other nurses at this hospital, and at this point, I bet their chances of reporting errors has just decreased. And I think that would be an interesting take or twist to put onto that silent treatment study is, how the hospitals are handling the shift in culture and then, you know, how that then flows down to all the staff members and how they react. So something to think about. We'll have to keep that on our plate and ask some of the nurses next year.
I think it's we've talked about this enough. I think it's, first of all, it's depressing and upsetting, and I don't know if there's a whole lot we can do about it, unfortunately, and that's a sad thing to say. So let's talk about bed bugs, something else that we can't really do a whole lot about. this has been an issue. I think these types of articles, or at least articles about bed bugs, have been surfacing more and more frequently regarding healthcare environments and bed bugs for the last several years. I've just, you know, from somebody who watches the healthcare news environment for my programming every week, I've just seen more and more articles about bed bugs in every kind of healthcare and situation, from ambulances to hospitals to long-term care. And every single one of those articles has said that bed bugs are annoying, they're bothersome, but they are not vectors, or they don't carry disease that it can be transmitted easily to humans. And this article, the headline is very alarming, but it essentially says so far that is still true. And the article says bed bugs among the homeless carry superbugs, according to a study that was undertaken in Toronto, superbugs being MRSA and VRSA. These are very common in the community. I know, Terry, you've talked about, you know, people coming in with infections. It's often community acquired. So they're out there in the wild, and not just the bedbugs, but everywhere.
Yes. And, you know, the height of my season for seeing cellulitis and abscesses, and I pretty much treat everything now like it's community acquired MRSA, if it's a cellulitis, is that it's going to be tick and mosquito season where we are. And what do? You scratch those bites and then you get cellulitis. But I thought this was interesting. I would never say that a bug couldn't be a vector for something. And my take on this is that most all of our Staph aureus and our enterococci are probably all becoming MRSA and VRE. We're just now seeing it transmitted. So anything that could carry bacteria, including humans, it's probably going to be resistant.
Yeah, I mean, humans are probably the number one way we transmit disease to each other, and yet we don't keep humans out of the hospitals. I just point this out. It's an alarming headline that farther down in the article says very clearly, hey, we don't see any evidence that anyone's received these bacterial infections from having bed bugs present. We're just saying that when we examine the insects themselves, we find evidence of these disorders.
Well, but then they also talked about that they were seeing a rise in the MRSA in this part of Vancouver where this study took place. And it has to do with the homeless and people in these really poor areas that they're living and not very good hygiene. And so they were in their own way associating in the article a rise in the MRSA in this population and a potential that they might be linked. And so that's another piece to this, is where the study took place and the information that they gathered. The other piece of it, though, is they took samples from just two people. And so I guess
that's not a very big N, is it?
No, and maybe it's
only the second smallest N there can be.
So I think I would like to see a little more study done or research on this, because it doesn't surprise me the information that they are saying is potential, but I would just still like to have my N a little bit larger.
Yeah, and who's speaking up for the bed bugs? I mean, the humans probably gave the bed bugs the MRSA and the VRE in the first place. Now, who's standing up for their rights?
Right, and you're actually, you know, it's funny, but you're right. we don't. It's very likely that the MRSA is existing on these individuals in other places, waiting for an opportunity to infect, and the bed bugs just happen to walk past it.
Yes.
Which, just says, it's all about your neighborhood. Find the good neighborhoods to live in.
The non-MRSA neighborhood.
That's right.
And if you're going to sleep under a bridge, make sure it's a clean one.
Insect real estate programs. I think we need to have some kind of housing and development program for bedbugs. I know it's silly, but, it's just one of those things. I've talked to a couple of friends of mine that work in the corporate and building extermination business, in that business environment. And they just say, bed bugs are just among one of the biggest hassles to really eradicate them. Even when you can do a full fumigation, which you can't do in a hospital because you've got ventilation systems that are hard to separate by room, you have no way of knowing whether you actually got rid of them, because they leave the patient and go and infest the room and go dormant for periods of time. So there's really no way to tell if you've gotten them all until they show up in the same room again. And then are they
it's
from
like
the
fleets.
Patient or are they from before?
Ooh, good question.
Yeah. So there's just a whole lot of things. And it's become one of those, we have to renew that whole thing of, before you go to bed, don't let the bed bugs bite, and because they might have MRSA.
So I have a question. If you get bitten by a bug in a hospital, is that then a hospital acquired infection?
Good question.
Oh yeah, because uh-huh. Medicare won't have to pay for that.
Right. Yeah.
So, and this is a huge deal when you look at, one of the other articles that we talked about in this episode, or I sent out to you, and we didn't actually specifically talk about it beforehand, but I think it's good to bring up, looking at the Medicaid, federal agencies looking for ways to save in Medicaid and Medicare patients, and this is one of those initiatives where they're not going to pay for certain types of hospital-acquired infections, but also they're looking at who they spend more money on. And there is a very small patient population that accounts for a huge amount of the cost.
Right. I found that very interesting in that article, and I'm hoping that we're okay to segue into that, me and my little healthcare reimbursement access to care.
Segue away.
But I found it very interesting that, and it talks about that 15% of the Medicaid enrollees are accounting for 40% of the spending. It's because they're enrolled in Medicaid and Medicare. And that's very interesting. Here we are putting so many resources in Medicaid towards children and pregnant women, which I totally believe that we should. But this is an area that I really never even thought of it. And maybe it has to do with the population that we serve, and we have such a low Medicare population because we're young. We have a younger area where I live. But that is interesting. So what can we do at pulling that data that when people are admitted to the hospital with Medicare and Medicaid, what are we doing to really make sure we're managing their care and making sure that that hospital system is working and talking together? And that's a huge percent. 40% of the costs come from those people.
Well, and there's a lot of reasons that healthcare costs are rising. You know, this is the sickest of the population. So these will be chronic and disabled who can't afford insurance. So they've got their Medicare and then they've got Medicaid to pay what Medicare doesn't and for primary care. And so, yes, streamlining. I'm surprised those two systems don't talk already. And then we would get back into electronic medical health records that we would have been better off to design one entire system that everybody plugged into. But that's not the way it went. But that's another show.
Several other shows.
Yeah, no kidding. I like that they pointed out that Kathleen Sebelius, who is a nurse, pointed out that just a 10% cost savings is $12 billion a year to that program. And so that's good. You know, another article that you sent us was about nurse-driven endoscopies, outpatient, and that the safety on those was identical and the education the patients got was a little bit better. And so, look, that's a good way to save some money, is by using nurse-managed health centers, nurses to do basic procedures. And really, all of us work together as a team. Now, another reason that costs are going through the roof is because hospitals are charging a whole lot more and drug companies charge a whole lot more. But that's also another episode.
Well, we've said it before when we were looking at the healthcare reform situation last year on the show. There is a lot more to the healthcare rising costs in healthcare than any one issue. However, this article points out, the nurse-driven open access colonoscopy article points out that there are ways to make significant improvements in savings, and saving 10% of the cost for these very ill patients with chronic illnesses is a huge savings overall every year. And I think that when we look at doing little things, I'm brought back to something I try to do all the time, which is make little improvements that over time add up to big improvements. And I think that this focus on we have to save healthcare and cause reform to happen overnight with the perfect package, I think we're better served to start looking at little bits and pieces along the way. And one of them is to increase access for other practitioners in the marketplace that have less of a cost associated with them, like not having to have a physician for a routine colonoscopy.
Preach it.
Hallelujah. Well, we've talked about this before, Terry, I think we're all impatient for the IOM report to have some kind of cascading effect across all of the states and all of the nurse practice acts, but it just seems like it's taking forever and the same issues keep coming up. And yet study after study after study gets released saying again and again that nurse-led primary care, nurse-led health initiatives have no significant difference in safety and outcome, and in fact, patient experience is often better. So why aren't we moving faster?
Called lobbyists. I mean, you're preaching to the choir. I practice in a state where it took 5 to 7 times before the Missouri legislature to even get a bill passed where nurses could write advanced practice nurses, we are one of only three states, write for controlled substances. We only get to write through class three, only for 72 hours. They passed the bill over two legislative sessions ago, 2 years ago, and yet it is not enacted. So 7 years later, said the nurse practitioner, I still cannot get my patient the treatment they need. And it comes right down to lobbyists and reform and turf wars. And that goes back to the culture. If we've all create a culture where I've got your back and we're all on the same team, I think we'd be much more productive.
You know, I think that it's interesting. One of the things that the IOM report said when they talked about nurses practicing to the full extent of their training and that improving access for advanced practice nurses to main providers of primary care, it talked about the anti-competitive, antitrust practices that are associated with the medical profession trying to keep us nurses down. And while we've talked about this many times, you know, their malpractice insurance protects them from a lot of things, but I don't think it protects them if somebody were to sue them for racketeering. You know, let's bring the docs up and these organizations and say, you are colluding to prevent access to care, to increase rising health costs, and to keep a whole group of the business sector in which you work away from taking your client base.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be interesting. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is not all physicians feel that way. The majority of them are open and receptive and collaborative and congenial. It's just the few extreme, and those are the people that tend to fuel the lobby and head places like the AMA. And so it's not only tragic because it's not a turf war between the professions, not only tragic for nursing, it's tragic for the patients because we're holding up their care and their access to care.
And Anne, these turf wars aren't just restricted to what happens between physicians and nurses. You know, nurses are as guilty of being involved in these turf wars as anyone else when it comes to somebody trying to come up with a way to provide care that nurses are not able to provide for whatever reason in a community.
Well, and I know that far too well, don't I? No. Yes, and I see that, you know, when, because my mind is just going a million miles on this topic of ways, you know, that to it, decrease these numbers and decrease these healthcare costs. But, you know, we need to look at all of our healthcare resources and what we can do to increase access to healthcare and provide the care that people need. And, you know, we don't have enough nurses right now where we are, and it's hard for us to recruit and replace nurses. And we've talked about that before. We have like 20,000 nurses retiring in the next couple of years here in Colorado. That's tough. Who's going to backfill that when we don't have this capacity in the school system in order to train them or the clinical sites, which we've talked about on a previous episode? But then we have situations such as, what about EMS and paramedics and them integrating with nurses in order to provide the care or integrating into public health and primary care? And but then nurses are having turf wars over that concept. And it's not about replacing you. It's about providing the care. And, you know, what can we do one health professional at a time to get them to open their eyes, to look beyond themselves and actually look at what's best for the patient? And if anything, you know, if you can share stories of successes where you see that happening and being able to communicate that message and just say, you know, let's step back and again, be that patient advocate that I know we all are and say, what is really best for the patient and what's best for our health of our population and what can we do to improve this situation? And I think, you know, there's potential and it's happening, but it is difficult. But it's all in the messaging and it's all, if you have that support from the top down in order to get that word out.
I agree.
And you know, one of the things I'm you know, anxiously waiting for, especially from the program with which you're associated and some of the other community EMS programs that are out there that are trying to provide services to their communities that don't have access to primary care, is really, I'd like to see the data. I'd like to see where the numbers fall on real costs. How much did it cost to have somebody have a follow-up visit by an EMS provider rather than in areas where there is no home nursing or patients that just need some re-education. How much, what are the real costs associated with what the real cost savings are? And so, you know, I know that that data is coming eventually, but I think that's just another study that can point out ways that the healthcare system can save a little bit here and a little bit there to add up to huge savings. But it's got to come. We got to stop these turf wars. And, you know, nurses scream and yell about the way the physicians are. I know I've talked to numerous primary care physicians that scream and yell about the way the specialists treat them. You know, it is, I mean, you talk to Dr. Anonymous, you talk to Mike over at his show, and you talk about family practice, and he will just sit there and go, oh, it's awful. You know, I'm supposed to not be able to do things that I used to be able to do in my practice because, you know, somebody says I'm not equipped or qualified because I'm not a specialist. And, you know, it's about providing, providing the patient the care they need at the time they need it in the most efficient and cost-effective and time-effective manner. Making patients wait to go see specialists for months because they can't get in because there's no access and there's not enough specialists to go around keeps them from getting the care they need and just makes them feel miserable.
It does. And we got to get over ourselves. We really do. And, Jamie, you know, we do care backwards anyway. We are very acute care driven, 80% or something like that of all healthcare dollars are spent on acute care. Oh my gosh, think if we had some paramedics and some nurses doing the preventative care, things like safety and blood pressure clinics and all of that. How much
money? That's what we're doing. Yay.
Yeah. We've got to turn this thing around to community-based care and preventative care and education and provide lots of support in those areas so that our acute healthcare costs go down. However, lots of people make lots of money off acute healthcare.
Right, I know. And I think that's really, it's the model, it's that community health model of like half prevention, half, you know, direct treatment. And so what can we do to really move towards that? And, you know, we hear physicians all the time in primary care talking about that they don't have the time in their 10-minute visit in order to hit that. So let's look at other healthcare resources to provide this. And, you know, just prevention. So every patient that's admitted that is covered by both Medicare and Medicaid, they should be flagged that they have discharge planning on them and, you know, that they're just flagged ahead of time that we can do whatever to prevent anything from happening in readmissions and what can we do for follow-up care with them. I mean, just let's target them ahead of time and try to decrease these numbers.
Well, and a good example of you know, the way that the acute care marketplace has gone, my mom is in her mid-70s. She doesn't take anything but PRN medications like, you know, Tylenol or something like that. And she went in and her cholesterol was on the borderline. It was like at 200. And the doctor's like, all right, I want to give you a prescription. So, all right, she's going to get prescribed a statin. My mom said, no, I don't want to take a drug. Isn't there something
Yay,
you can do?
For her.
And the doctor's like, well, what do you mean? I mean, she goes, well, if my cholesterol is high, it must be something I'm eating. So maybe I need to look at my diet. Do you have a diet plan? They literally had to go into a closet and open up a box and dust off a few pamphlets that they had put away years ago with heart-healthy diets that improve your cholesterol.
It's discouraging, Jamie, but less pharma is always better. Oh my gosh, the polypharmacy we have on our geriatric patients, and it's just fast. You know, I can just write this script and I know the dose and I've got it written in my head, but holy mackerel, Batman, the risks involved with it alone, let alone the cost.
Well, and it's about time. I mean, we know that the model for primary care for physicians and for specialists is get them in fast, find out what's wrong, get them a prescription and send them out the door, or get them treatment of some sort, and then get on to the next patient, because you only make money if you can see more patients in a day. And that's unfortunately the way it works in the system that we have right now, the managed care and everything else has gone that way. So how do we deal with that if we don't give, you know, if we don't have a prevention model, we're just going to continue down this path. And interestingly enough, I bring that up about my mom because she said to me that she went back for a 6-month follow-up and she followed the diet. She basically reduced, you know, some of her, grew up on a dairy farm. She drinks milk like it's going out of style. And she just cut back. And amazingly enough, she dropped her cholesterol by 20%, doing nothing but changing her diet. Now, she's very active. You know, she's not a typical 75-year-old senior, but certainly there's an indication that just a little bit of education.
Wait, Jamie, she should be the typical 75.
She should be. But if she was the typical, and here's the conflict of interest. If she was the typical patient, how much money would Lipitor lose?
Yeah. I mean, well, and we've done the same thing with orthopedic replacement of knees and hips. And I read an article the other day that, you know, what we do when patients come in and we do NSAIDs and they fail that and yada, yada, then we send them on to the orthopedic surgeon. And that, you know, that's where hospitals are generating revenue. All these orthopedic hospitals are going up because we have all these baby boomers who are going to replace their knees and we're going to replace their hips. But the standard of care and the number one treatment for osteoarthritis of the knee or hip is weight loss.
Yep.
But we're not supporting people in doing that. Weight loss and exercise.
And weight loss and exercise, I mean, if you get those down, you remove the need for perhaps at least some portion of the blood pressure medication most of these people are taking. You reduce the statin drugs they're taking. You reduce, in some cases for the males, maybe their erectile dysfunction drug that they're mm-hmm. taking. And suddenly you've reduced the profits to a huge portion of the medical device and pharmaceutical industry by 50% just by having a healthier population.
It's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. So we'll just keep giving everybody pills.
Sounds good to me.
You know, we're getting ready to close up, but I couldn't leave us without at least talking about what are we going to do when the zombie apocalypse hits and you're a nurse.
You know, I don't know.
And people were probably scratching their heads going, what did he just say? I point this out because there was a great article I found. The University of Calgary has a nursing program that they run in Qatar, which is a Middle East country along the Persian Gulf, and they wanted to change viewpoints on who nurses were and what they do, and they came up with an idea to create a game about nurses and zombies. And I just don't say this is insane, don't say it's crazy, just go play it, because it is a lot of fun. The nurses, every other zombie game I've ever seen, you shoot the zombies. Not nurses. Nurses treat the zombies, fix the zombies, and send them on their way, along with the other regular patients. So you should check the link out for this game, because triaging regular patients and zombies simultaneously in the same waiting room probably leads to a higher incidence of hospital-acquired zombieism.
Don't worry about bed bugs. Worry about zombies. I played this game because I want to be prepared should we ever have zombie apocalypse.
Yes, and how are we going to triage them? Yes.
Well, clearly we need to have separate waiting rooms because, you know, the farther I went in the game, I ended up getting, you know, more of my well patients were getting bit by zombies and turning into zombies. And, you know, this epidemic is an issue and we have the treatment for them, but we need to stop triaging them in the same room.
It's like the pediatric clinic where you have one for the well kids and a waiting room for the sick kids. Do you think zombies would read the signs?
I don't know, but you know, I could just see the person sitting behind the desk, you know, slide the little window aside and go, and you hear, please go to the zombie room.
Be with you in a moment, sir. Do you have your insurance card?
Yeah, and pick up your hand before you leave. Thank you.
Hand sanitizer.
This game was a lot of fun, and I think it just is there's a couple of games that came out recently. I know Johnson & Johnson released through their campaign for Nursing's Future, released their nursing game online, soon to be on a mobile device near you.
Yes, Happy Nurse.
Happy Nurse, and just a lot of fun. I mean, I think it's good, clean fun to have some places for nurses to be nurses in a game.
Well, and I think other part of this article, they wanted to put this together so they could educate people about really the true profession of nursing to recruit more people to become nurses. And so it's the fact that they are treating and triaging patients is the whole idea behind this is, you know, they call it that it's the angry birds for nurses. So what can we do to recruit more nurses? This to me was one of the most creative avenues I've ever thought of. to recruit nurses.
And they look at a lot of different stereotypes that they're looking at in this. I mean, there's a male nurse, female nurse, multiracial. We have changes of shift, so you can be playing one nurse and then the shift changes and another nurse comes in. It's hilarious. It's a lot of fun. I urge you to check it out. I know my kids are enjoying it too. So good, clean fun. And the only thing I would point out is, you know, again, acute care is sexy. And where is the zombie prevention module that nurses should be looking for?
Oh, we would just be giving shots left and right. You know that.
That's not all public health nurses do, but that would be good. How to not become a zombie. Number one, stay away from the zombies.
I know. Get vaccinated against zombies.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Go ahead and bite me.
We'll
I've been
your height and weight and head circumference.
Oh my goodness gracious! Well, look, I think we've touched on all these. I'm amazed we got through every single article. I think because a lot of them tied together very well. I take no credit for that because it happened completely accidentally. But before we head out, I just want to check in, Terry. Where can we find more of you online?
Oh, at nursestory.com, and I actually did get to putting up a couple posts this last week. So more to read, always at my blog.
And it's always a great read. I'm looking forward to heading over there and checking them out. And Anne, we're working on getting you a place online. But in the meantime, people can follow you on Twitter.
And on Facebook. Well, maybe not really. Only if I befriend you. But on Twitter.
Don't give it up, Anne.
So here's the hint, folks. When you go to Caring Anne on Facebook, you want to send her a note saying, hey, I listen to you on Insights. And maybe she'll friend you.
That would be perfect.
Excellent. Well, it's always great having both of you on the show, and it's just been a lot of fun today. Do want to remind everybody, you can, of course, find me on my programs over at the ProMed Network, including The Nursing Show at nursingshow.com, and, of course, all the other great programs at the ProMed Network. Go to promednetwork.com. And just got a heads up today that some of my friends are putting together an initiative. We're actually going to have our own network channel in iTunes for the ProMed Network. So all the shows on the ProMed Network will have a ProMed channel, network channel in iTunes, which is very cool. That's a big deal. I mean, that puts us right next to every other major network that has podcasts, including all the TV networks and everything else. It's really cool. So looking forward to that coming into place. Should be in place in the next week or so. In the meantime, you can get back to me and follow up on all the information talked about in this episode over at insightsinnursing.com and send those emails in to insightsinnursing@gmail.com. I'm Jamie Davis. We'll be back again soon with another episode of Insights in Nursing as we bring our panelists of educated and well-wishing nurses together to talk about everything from A to Z, including zombies in nursing.